Was Mary free to say no? At first glance, the Annunciation may seem like a strange place to go for a sermon on consent. The history of interpretation that we have received has often emphasized Mary's passivity and submission to God's will. We see this not just in our academic commentaries and theology, but also in our hymns. The well-known hymn, The Angel Gabriel, starts its final line with, "Then gentle Mary meekly bowed her head. To me be as it pleases God," she said. While this is the story that has been told in the past, the beautiful thing about stories is that each generation is able to approach them with a new set of lenses. So, let's take a moment and pause. Everyone take a deep breath and step back from the biblical story and its history for just a few seconds. What is consent? Consent is an intransitive verb meaning to give assent or approval. When used as a noun, consent means compliance or in or approval of what is done or proposed by another. Often today, when we hear consent talked about, it's in relation to romantic and or sexual relationships or any other type of physical touch between individuals. However, this isn't the only place that we can practice consent. We practice consent in our platonic relationships, whenever we ask to take someone's photo. We practice consent in difficult conversations, when we check in and ask how the other person is doing, when we ask if they're engaged in our conversation or debate, or if they need to pause and take a step back. As Anabaptist Christians, we practice consent in our baptism ritual, rather than baptizing infants. In our tradition, baptism is a free choice to claim something about your beliefs and to voluntarily join our community as we seek to follow Jesus. So, with these definitions and examples in mind, let's return to the biblical text. Let's set the scene. We've just come from the big city. Elizabeth and Zechariah have just learned that they're going to have a child in their old age. And the scene opens on a 12 to 14-year-old girl named Miriam, living in a small town in Galilee, one of the backwater regions of the Roman Empire. Now, Galilee has been a hotbed for rebels who are hoping to kick out the Romans and restore home rule and the Hasmonean dynasty. Miriam's parents have even possibly named her after the last Hasmonean princess who was married to Herod the Great and whose death marked the end of the Hasmonean dynasty and the start of Roman rule. Anyway, Miriam is going about her life when suddenly a stranger appears out of nowhere in her house and tells her to be happy and rejoice, and then immediately, don't be afraid of the stranger in your house. Because, surprise, you're pregnant. Now, Miriam might be young, but she knows a thing or two about the world, and although she's engaged to this guy named Joseph, she hasn't known him in the biblical sense, and she's getting a bit skeptical and rather logically asks, how can this be? And the stranger, for their part, comes back with this wonderfully clear line about being overcome and overshadowed by the Spirit of God. And anything is possible with God, you see, because Elizabeth, your relative, she's pregnant too. And Mary's response to this is simple. Here am I, a servant of the Lord. Let it be with me according to your word. The poem that we heard earlier by Denise Levertov is a good counter to the traditional interpretation of the Annunciation. Levertov says, "We are told of meek obedience. No one mentions courage. The engendering spirit did not enter her without consent. God waited. She was free to accept or to refuse. Choice integral to humanness. In her reimagining, Levertov says this is not a power over decree of the intent of God, but rather it is an invitation to power with. God waits for a response and invites Mary to join God as a co-creator, a participant in the coming restoration. In my Christian Theology 2 class last semester, I was struck by Melinda Berry's comments during our Mariology unit that we don't know how many women Gabriel asked before he asked Mary. We don't know how many women said no to God's question. Mary is remembered because she said yes. And we see in her response the hallmarks of consent. Mary questions the angel. She asks for specifics of what is going to happen. And the angel tries their best to answer that question. While the language of overcoming and overshadowing may sound forceful to us today, feminist scholar Barbara Reed argues that this language would have been familiar to Luke's audience. She says that the verbs used, epeleusetai, to come upon, and episkiase, to overshadow, evoked for the original readers God's protective and empowering presence by using some of the same language that is used in Genesis 1 and Exodus for the Spirit of God coming upon the waters of creation and overshadowing the tabernacle in the wilderness. Mary does not receive the specifics of how the baby will be conceived. Although Luke, for his part, is very intentional about not using sexual language for the interaction between God and Mary. But she does receive the assurance that nothing is impossible with God, and that God will be present with her as she navigates the complexities of being a betrothed, yet unmarried, pregnant woman in a patriarchal society. While Mary's yes is simple in this text, we see just a few verses later in the Magnificat her enthusiastic consent to join what God is doing in the world. Her response is also the perfect answer for a prophet. Reed says that in everything but name, Luke depicts Mary as a prophet of the line of the female prophets of the First Testament. His language draws on the prophetic calls of Moses. Like Moses, Mary is at home in her daily life when she is called by God to join in what God is doing. Her response, "Here am I," has echoes of the prophets before her. And friends, I wish that I could say that that is where the text ends, that we were left with this beautiful, not very complex picture of God inviting a young woman to join the plan for restoration and shalom, and she giving her consent. But friends, that is not where the text ends. Mary's response is, "Here am I, a slave of God. Let it be with me according to your word." Was Mary free to say no? There's this pervasive myth that slavery in the ancient world was not nearly as brutal as what was seen in the era of American chattel slavery or modern-day slavery and trafficking. I want to say this is not true. The Roman Empire was built on the backs of enslaved human beings who were seen as the lowest of the lowly. Womanist scholar Mitzi Smith says that many Roman enslavers were known for their cruelty. Quote, "Slaves possessed no honor in Roman society. The enslaved were forcefully uprooted from their family, homeland, and culture, and had no rights. Enslavers possessed total access to the bodies, sexuality, and labor of slaves they owned." The society that we read about in the Second Testament was a slave society. The Bible itself makes use of slave metaphors throughout the Second Testament. Often these references today are translated euphemistically as servant, But for those of us who live in a society that was built using slave labor, it is important to give attention to these references. In Slavery and Social Death, Orlando Patterson examines slavery from the ancient world to the modern world. He concludes that there are four key elements that define slavery. First, it is a parasitic relationship, where the enslaver solely benefits from the exploitation of the enslaved. Second, it is maintained by extreme domination and threats of coercive violence. Third, it alienates the enslaved from society by severing familial relationships. And fourth, it dishonors and dehumanizes the enslaved individual. With this understanding of the history of slavery in the ancient Near East, it's important to take seriously Mary's self-identification as a slave of God. Womanist Bible scholar Dr. Raquel Letsum argues in her article, Mary's Slave Song, the tensions and turnabouts of faithfully reading Dulé in the Magnificat, that Mary's self-identification as a slave allows us to view the point of connection between Mary and enslaved blacks. Mary serves as a beacon of resistance. Although she is a slave linguistically, Luke positions her narratively as one who defies the deleterious elements that Orlando Patterson uses to define slavery. Mary's depiction and use of slave language is a homeopathic practice, a vaccination that mimics the disease enough for the body to rally its defense against it. Mary's slave language is the modified dose of the disease of slavery, and Mary's narrative depiction rallies against it. In this relationship, God and Mary act as an inoculation to undermine the oppressive systems of slavery in the world of the text. It taps into what Brian Blount calls the ethic of reversal in Luke. Here, God, as the powerful one, is asked to wait, to restrain. And Mary, as the powerless, has all of the power in the interaction. As Dr. Letsum notes, the relationship between God and Mary reverses all of Patterson's elements of slavery. It is not God alone that benefits from power over Mary, but rather one of mutuality, where both Mary and God benefit from their relationship. Domination and violent coercion is transformed into consent. Mary is not alienated from her family, but is instead brought closer to Elizabeth and Joseph through her pregnancy, and she is not dishonored, but is called highly favored and blessed. God and Mary's relationship reverses the dehumanizing systems of oppression by humanizing and offering agency to Mary. So, what does this reversal mean for those of us who claim to follow Jesus? I think we're offered a challenge. Last week, Ben invited us to consider how we use relational and organizational power to affect change in our communities and societal structures. As we're looking to affect change in our world, it is also important to be aware of those who our society denies agency to. Often, these are the people who are most marginalized in our societies and communities. We must realize that if the oppressed do not have any agency in our communities, then there is no way they can consent to the way that we are transforming them. If we as a community truly value consent, then we are called to create communities that extend agency to those which society has denied agency. This requires that those of us who have power must be willing to restrain it, to be willing to become meek. We are called to invite those who are marginalized and oppressed to the center, to be participants in transforming systems that oppress. Was Mary free to say no? I believe the answer to that question is yes. Despite the power differential, Mary had the agency to say no to God and chose to give her consent. In the Annunciation, we find an inoculation against systems that exploit and strip agency from the powerless. We see the reversal of a system of domination where the powerless have no agency to effect change or to consent to societal transformation. Instead, we see a new example of power with, where those who without agency are lifted up and given agency, where the powerful are invited to meekness and the weak are invited to embrace power, so that all may be active participants in God's transformative work. Thanks be to God.